Well, it's interesting you brought up what transmigrates, because that's one of the things I wanted to talk with you about. And I'm curious, first of all, what you see as the difference when an enlightened human being dies and what happens to their path or lack of a path of transmigration compared to a human who's not enlightened. Like, what do these two different deaths look like in terms of the subtle and causal bodies?
Right. I can tell you what the... So generally what the traditions say, and then...
You keep leaning on these traditions, Ken.
Well, you try to touch bases with, you know, the geniuses that came before.
I always want to know what you think.
Well, though, before you trash
and so
them.
When you, so when you disagree, be clear to underscore that.
I always do that because you sort of really want to see what they say, and then I'll tell you what I think about it. So I usually try to get to that point at some point. And the transmigration thing is by far the most difficult of all of them. The evidence for it is... shaky, to put it mildly. The Dalai Lama can't remember his past lives. I don't know why Shirley MacLaine can remember her past life. And the type of evidence that you're going to accept for this is therefore very, very hard to come by. Some researchers, Ian Stevenson is fairly well known. He's done empirical research. A typical book title is 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, and that's how he treats it. He's a scientist. He'll look at people that have anomalous scars or really interesting birthmarks or something and trace back evidence where a previous person had a particular type of death that would have left that mark, and there's reasons to believe that this person might be reborn and it's from that person. So, but that's one way to look at it. It's suggestive. It doesn't prove anything. One of the reasons that I tend to shy away from a whole lot of discussion about reincarnation and transmigration is that everything else we've talked about, quadrants and levels and lines and states and types, including non-dual awareness, is something that can be demonstrated right here and right now with competent individuals. So we can argue higher states of consciousness, and we can give a lot of evidence for it. We can argue higher stages of consciousness, and we can give a lot of evidence for that. Argue reincarnation, we don't got a lot of evidence for that. And if you're going to hook all that other stuff to reincarnation, you're going to get in trouble. Because people are going to go, oh, well, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. So I'm very, very careful, because part of what I have to do is try to come up with evidence for these things. And so I have some personal beliefs about it. I happen to think it's true, but I'll tell you why. But I'm also very, very suspicious about my own beliefs in that regard, as I am of almost anybody else's that has them. It's very easy to kid yourself in these matters. But it's really important to realize that Satori, an evidence for a non-dual state, we can give a lot of really, really powerful evidence for that, including EEG stuff and interpretive and hermeneutic and phenomenological evidence and empirical studies. Very impressive stuff. Reincarnation, not impressive. Extremely not impressive. So I'll tell you what the traditions say, and then I'll tell you my own thoughts about it and my own limited experience on it. Well, the general theory about reincarnation is that an individual soul is born, and in a sense, even though that individual soul is one with the ocean, even though that individual wave is 100% wet, just as wet as anything else is in the way, it doesn't realize it's one with the ocean. It doesn't realize that it's one with all things, and therefore it thinks that it's a separate, bounded, finite thing. It thinks it's an object among other objects, and because it separates itself from the totality of existence, then it suffers, it has pain, it has desire, it has fear, envy, and so on. This catastrophe of a state, known as the separate self, continues to gather experience until it realizes that it's one with the ground of all existence, until it realizes that it is one with Godhead, one with Spirit. And at that point, reincarnation ceases. There is no reason for it to be reborn and suffer as a separate individual soul that's going to be tormented and tortured and drawn and quartered and die. That's the general statement. Then the traditions give two subplots under that. If you're enlightened, it's a nice restaurant and you have a few choices on the menu. The first choice is you don't have to be reborn. Second choice is you get to choose. So the idea here is that during the bardo, and there are very specific stages in the bardo that are described as well as states, everybody at the moment of death is plunged into the causal formless realm, the Dharmakaya. Ordinary individuals still have grasping, clinging, desiring tendencies, and therefore they contract away from this boundless, clear light emptiness because they can't, in a sense, they can't stand the infinite radiance of it. some traditions would say that you can't stand to see the face of God, except this isn't the face of God. This is your own original face. This is what you are at that moment and at all times. But being starkly confronted with your own isness, the average soul contracts against that, away from that, and into the subtle realm. And so during the afterlife state, during the subtle realm, this is a period where all sorts of visions start to appear. Some of them are very alluring, some of them are very frightening. Peaceful deities, wrathful deities, all come crashing onto the scene. And depending upon your own karmic desires, choices, needs, and so on, you'll be attracted to some of these and repulsed by others. A highly evolved soul, at that point, will choose the type of rebirth that he or she wants. Just as you can choose what you wish to lucid dream, if you can lucid dream. Now, they actually maintain that's the same process. In other words, if you gain access to consciously lucid dreaming and controlling the entire subtle realm as it arises, that's the same subtle realm and the same subtle body that arises in the Bardo realm. So if you can control that and master that through dream yoga during your lifetime, then in the afterlife, Bardo realm, when you're being taken through the same dream state, you'll be able to choose that just like you can choose your dreams. So there are a couple other things you kind of have to do, but that's essentially what they maintain. And so an enlightened person can actually choose rebirth. And when that happens, the unenlightened person contracts from the subtle into the gross, and then it's reborn to a man and woman that it sees as its parents, and it tries to step between them and ends up born in a gross body, and it forgets all of the previous stages. Each of those is marked, each of those steps from causal to subtle to gross, there's a profound forgetting, and then you end up reborn, forgetting all of those higher states that are your own potential. And then evolution is a process of reversing that, in a sense, of regaining access to these higher and higher states and stages of consciousness. If you're enlightened, you get to choose the descent, and that is a descending path that we're talking about, causal to subtle to gross. That's another type of descent or descending movement. And if you're enlightened, you get to choose that reentry, is how that goes. And if not, it's chosen for you. You're pushed around the same way you were pushed around in life by those forces that you have not transcended. So to the extent that you can transcend your lower desires, then you can select that during that process. That rebirth continues until you have ascended, evolved, or grown back up to these higher states and stages that you run away from every time you die. So you can consciously, when you die, remain awake, just as during your life, you could remain conscious through waking, dream, and deep sleep. Same thing. So when you can maintain that 24-hour constant consciousness, that turiya state, the witnessing state, then upon death, you can also remain aware during all of these events. And so you'll be able to select them and not be pushed around by them. But if you haven't, if you're still identified with some of them or attached to them and so on, then they will guide you. They will push you into your destiny of rebirth. That keeps going until you get off. But again, there's selections then, according to the traditions, which is if you're aware, then you indeed can choose rebirth. If you're in a Tolku or lineage tradition, then you sort of have to. It's sort of part of the rules. You get to be a Tolku by agreeing to come back in that lineage. And if you don't, you get in trouble. Bodhisattva vow has been taken to mean that, the generic meaning is that you will keep coming back in order to benefit all beings. It's sometimes interpreted to mean that you will put off your enlightenment until all others are enlightened. But that's not quite correct, because if you're not enlightened, you can't help anybody. The Bodhisattva vow really means I vow to gain enlightenment as quickly as possible for the benefit of all sentient beings. Because that means not only can I then help sentient beings, which I couldn't do if I wasn't enlightened. I'd just be an ignorant dolt like them. I mean, you know, who's helping who? But not only can you help other sentient beings by being enlightened, you can select your own rebirth process as you come back again and again to continue helping individuals evolve to their own highest estate, which is their own ever-present awareness.
So in terms of the menu and the choices that might exist for an enlightened person,
yes,
there's the choice to come back and be of service, and there's the choice not to reincarnate. What about the choice to incarnate in a different dimension than the human dimension? Do you think are there other choices on this? This is a very fancy restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
You'd think that you could sort of make it to order kind of thing. I have a special order.
And that's exactly the topic I like to include, you know, right up there with discussing quadrants, levels, and lines, because there's so much evidence for that. It's like, not only can you choose how to be reborn, it's like you can choose to be reborn in the seventh ring of the fourth heaven, left of Alpha Centauri. Yes, the traditions maintain you can be reborn, literally show up in any of the realms of existence. And there's a certain sense in which an enlightened being does so anyway. In other words, we're always transmitting to each other our state of awareness and consciousness. And an enlightened person, somebody who has access to a non-dual state, is transmitting that. And it's not really something they have a lot of control over. Because it's just not that part of it that you control in any event. It's like saying, I have control over how much gravity my body gives off. You don't. It's just, it's there. If you awaken this non-dual awareness in a permanent fashion, you're just always giving off those rays. And those, because they're dimensionless in a sense, because they're ever-present, appear in all realms anyway. So an awakened one is already appearing in all the realms of existence and showing up in various forms in all of those realms. Individuality is not. And so could a particular individual migrate to those other heavens? It almost becomes meaningless at that point. But I know what you mean by the question, and the traditions would say yes. If you want to be reborn in a specific realm and help beings there, you can do that. Not much different than if you choose to, if you're really lucid dreaming, and you wanted to imagine a heavenly realm and see yourself going there, you can do it. That's what happens in a dream state. Whatever you... If you can conceive it, it will appear instantly in the dream state. So if you can have that conception, you will appear in that realm if you're awakened, and if that's what you choose to do. Most of the action is in the precious human body realm, because that's where beings can be awakened, and therefore that's where the most good can be done in a certain sense.
Well, I want to take a brief tangent here into lucid dreaming, because it seems that it's a really critical skill to develop. So I'm wondering what your suggestions would be for somebody who wants to get better at lucid dreaming.
Yes, I think it's a very good practice, because there's several things at once. When people start to lucid dream, one of the first things that happens is they're shocked at, well, first, the fact that they can do it, but second, the fact that of just how real the dream appears, because we all know that anyway. We all wake up from a dream and go, wow, I can't believe I really bought into that. And as we mentioned previously, the Satori experience, or the awakening experience, is having just that experience in relation to waking state. You actually wake up from waking state and go, whoa, I can't believe I bought that. That's a great relief, I mean, to put it mildly. Lucid dreaming gives you a taste of all of that, but it also starts exercising the muscle that helps you do that more and more in any event, which is a capacity to take this ever-present witnessing awareness. And that witnessing awareness is only half of the non-dual equation. It leaves out the earth and the pagan half, which is important. But you have to exercise the witness side. You have to have both of them there. And being able to witness during the dream state means you are disidentified from the dream state. You're no longer identified with the partial self that's appearing in the dream state. You're aware of it. And because of that, you can actually control, create anything you want. That is accompanied by a growing realization that just as that dream state, there's a awakeness in the dream state. The waking state is a dream. In other words, they tend to balance each other out, and they're both sort of dream-like appearances of this ever-present wakefulness, which is what you really are. And this ever-present wakefulness, or I am-ness, or witness, increasingly starts to shine. Its own capacity becomes stronger and stronger in the midst of changing circumstances, fluctuating states and experiences, and so on. And gaining a capacity for a dream yoga or a lucid dreaming is a wonderful way, again, to take advantage of states that are ever-present, no matter what stage you're at. And that's another reason that's very, very important to work with these states of consciousness. Because you can do this if you're at level 1 or level 2 or level 3 or level 4 or level 5, any of those. And it's part of what we were calling, in a sense, horizontal health. It's really being everything you can be, no matter what stage you're at. And that's going to make you move through the stages faster. And lucid dreaming certainly will. So the number of my recommendations are, and again, I don't want to, Stephen LeBurge has done an enormous amount of work, and I certainly recommend you start there. There are traditional approaches to this. Tibetan dream yoga is probably one of the best and best known, but increasingly one of the things that I think is very important is we have a lot of brain-mind machines, Western approaches that will help you track when you're in a theta state, give you a small signal a beep in your ear or a little, you can wear this, a little apparatus on your head at night with ear phones and an iPad with a little light in it. And it will take your brain state, let you know when you're dreaming, and then give you a little signal. And increasingly, you can use that to slowly learn to lucid dream. And again, there you'll find many approaches to doing that. But I really recommend using that kind of brain-mind machine because they're very, very helpful.
Now, going back to the death experience for a moment, thank you. There are these remarkable stories of enlightened people and what happens to their bodies when they die. I mean, stories right. like the only thing that's left are hair and nails.
Yeah, isn't like, that funny? Now, what's
going
on with
that? Why on
earth would that be left
yeah.
behind?
Yeah. Do you think that those stories are true? And if so, how could you explain something like that?
Well,
Tell me what the traditions say.
Yes, exactly. Dawned on me, I didn't tell you what I thought about reincarnation myself because I'd just given you sort of the report. So I'll tell you both because I believe in reincarnation, but I don't believe in this tooth and nails thing. The reincarnation, I believe it's there. It makes sense to me. I've only had one or two experiences that struck me as some sort of trans life or rebirth experiences.
Ken, we were lovers in a past life. You and me.
That's correct.
In Egypt.
That's right.
I can't believe you don't remember that.
Only one or two non-embarrassing memories
sorry.
That I can come up with. And they tend to have an almost disembodied transcendental witness kind of thing. I wrote a book called Up from Eden, which was an experience I actually had in about 15 minutes. I saw sort of all of history unfold. I usually don't see things this way. I usually don't write this way. And I basically was the single self present at all of those times. So I sort of saw humanity unfold in first person singular. And the traditions will say, well, that's nothing new. That's just the, you know, Atman, transcendental self, big deal. I agree. I mean, big deal. I don't remember Ken Wilber being at any of those places. And I certainly don't have any past life memories of being somewhere. And people always come up with such wonderful, you know, it's so flattering, some of the people that they think that you are, you know. So you get all these really great ones. So I don't think I was Plotinus. I think I was Duncey Spurtferger, who ran the delicatessen right down the street from where Plotinus worked. And I just think they got their vibes crossed when they say that that's what I am. I have no memory of any of those kinds of things. I do think it makes sense. I think that happens. I think Aurobindo had an interesting point that souls, not all souls transmigrate, that you actually have to kind of get to a density of soul such that it's strong enough to survive the bardo realm. Lesser ones, let's say a soul of a worm, perhaps, or a chipmunk or something, it's not strong enough, subtle, or causal consciousness. So it's going to disintegrate when the gross body disintegrates. So I think sufficiently developed souls tend to do that. It makes sense, and that's it. The evidence, I think, is spotty. It's just something I really don't. I don't see a whole lot of reason to go into it, except it's there. The enlightened people, they go up in a rainbow body and they leave behind hair and tethered out. What have they got against teeth? I mean, if I'm going to be in Tetsuga heaven for a couple billion years, I want some teeth. If they're going to be up there kind of gumming their way through eternity, and I don't know what the exact point of that would be. And every time I hear stories like that, I have had some absolutely extraordinary Tibetan teachers. And all of them, none of them have ever seen this, that they always know somebody who's seen it. And somebody who's seen pulling an arrow out of a rock or somebody flying or levitating. And it's not that I disbelieve them. It's just that there's a whole capacity. Well, if you give them a lie detector test, they'll pass. That's what I mean. They're not lying in any sense of trying to deceive people. It's just the whole atmosphere of the sort of magical background can seep into these higher things, higher states. These are very profound things. And particularly when you come from a tradition that grew itself out of a kind of a Bon magical tradition where magic is the proof of a kind of spiritual realization, then that becomes the same, you know, it's sort of necessary that an enlightened person do something really magical. And I can think of a lot of really cooler magical things than leaving your teeth and hair behind. I mean, I think it should be like, they do a triple flip in the rainbow body over the Empire State Building or something. I mean, sprinkling fairy dust all across the Northeast. That would be cool. That would be something to work for. I would meditate hard if I could do that. I don't want to meditate hard just to leave my teeth behind. I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that's part of it. I don't think that's what the rainbow body is. I think it's part of folklore that's come with it. And I don't know a single teacher that's done it.
Is there some aspect, though, specifically just of the rainbow body stories that make sense in terms of the subtle body or the causal body, so you could
absolutely
understand?
Absolutely.
And so
absolutely.
Could you explain that?
Yeah, that part, again, is fine. I don't have any trouble with that. And again, there can be many different variations on this theme, but the general theme is that when you have a permanent realization, and that means that you are using this, the chakra system as an example, not only can you stay at the seventh chakra, you've illumined all seven, first, second, third, they're all lit up, they're all radiant, you've in some sense profoundly befriended all seven of these dimensions of manifest existence, and the gross body dies, then that subtle and causal body itself could continue to the next gross body rebirth, if that's what you chose. But that radiant, subtle, causal body would be the rainbow body. And I don't have any trouble with that as the vehicle in which enlightened souls go through the bardo and return, or go to some other realm to teach, or simply abide as the absolute realm itself and don't return at all. That's fine. I don't have any trouble with that.
So this is a slightly awkward question, but do you believe that you chose this incarnation as Ken Wilber, tall, handsome, bald guy?
Not really. Not like that. I think when I look at the interests I have and the currents of things that I'm attracted to, I can put myself in a frame where I could see why I would choose those. I can see why I would choose the parents I chose, for example, which itself is an interesting sort of game to play. And I know a couple of sort of transpersonal Freudians, which Seymour Borstein, wonderful. And one of his standard questions, you know, when patients or clients start sort of bad-mouthing their parents, is the first thing he'll say is, well, why did you choose them? And it really sort of catches people off a little bit. I can see that, those kinds of currents. There are the aspects that you touch into that are timeless, are just that, they're timeless. So I don't, to the extent that I've had any deeper realizations, in my own case, they relate to a depth of the present, not something that Ken Wilber was doing in the past, if that makes sense. So I don't relate to, oh, I'm this Ken Wilber bopping through one life to another, but more this infinity of depth that is what is prior to Ken Wilber in any event. So my realizations have to do more with what's prior to Ken Wilber than Ken Wilber himself. I don't have that kind of, I was put here with this kind of mission that I chose, or I needed to do this or something. I've never quite had that. I think it happens, but I haven't had that. And I think I kind of stumbled into what I ended up doing. I wrote my first book very early when I was 23, but I didn't know I wanted to do any of that until I was 21. I mean, I was studying to be a physician, a doctor, so I was a scientist and all that. And all of this is kind of new. I mean, I don't think I evidenced anything, you know. I wasn't 3 or 4 years old writing spiritual sonatas or whatever Mozart does under those circumstances.
So if then you didn't choose it, it was your unconscious
yes,
patterns.
I think that. I don't.
This is a humble moment.
No, that's good. People are going to think I'm unhumble and on the balance. No, I think that's I think that happens more often than not. And even the traditions they maintain that basically all that's really carried from one life to another is not personal memories. Those die with the gross body. They're in the gross brain. They die with the gross body. An actual, oh, I was a slave in Egypt, so that's usually not what is carried over. And I'm very suspect of those kinds of things anyway. Traditions maintain that there's an indestructible drop or essence in the heart, and that goes from rebirth to rebirth, and it contains only two things, your accumulation of wisdom and virtue. And wisdom means your capacity to understand emptiness, and virtue means your capacity to do good. And those capacities are carried with you, not some specific personality quirkiness that would sort of bounce along with you. So I'd like to think that there's a certain wisdom and virtue that sort of was tagging along. But I don't think there was a, you know, I think Ken Wilber just kind of, you know, showed up. The first time I met him was 2 or 3 years old. I don't know where exactly he came from.
Came from clay.
This concludes Session 6 of Cosmic Consciousness with Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 7.